You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Hi everybody, producer Al here. After a brief midwinter break, we are back re-releasing more classic TSFB Presents episodes here on the Monday podcast feed for you guys. If you remember, our latest series is a history of transfers, which patrons first listened to back in 2019. And in this week's episode, we discuss literally the biggest transfers in terms of impact in La Liga history. I also want to remind you, as you heard about on the Monday podcast, as you may have seen on our social media feeds, we're really excited about this new TSFB merch. Order now, because it's an initial limited run only available until March 8th. If there's huge demand, hopefully there'll be more in the future. But for now, it's only a very limited 2-week run. Check out the merch and enjoy this episode of A History of Transfers.
Hello patrons, welcome to another edition of TSFB Presents A History of Transfers. In the last episode, we spoke about some of the most important transfers in the history of La Liga, the ones that had had the biggest impact on their respective sides. There were a couple of important names that we missed out, actually four big names that we didn't talk about, and we thought we'd dedicate an entire episode to speaking about possibly the two most important signings in the history of Barcelona and possibly the two most important signings in the history of Real Madrid. I think you can guess who we're talking about. Obviously, for
Thomas Gravesen.
Faubert, yeah. Faubert and
Chiringuisky.
What was that?
Faubert went, wow.
Yes. Although there is a connection to Faubert, because of course, famously in his presentation as a Real Madrid player, standing alongside him,
true,
looking bemused and sort of angry, but he often did quite look quite angry, was
Alfredo Di Stefano, who we're going to be talking about alongside Johan Cruyff, Leo Messi and Cristiano Ronaldo, as you could probably guess. So we'll start off chronologically by talking about Alfredo Di Stefano and his signing for Real Madrid in 1953 from Millonarios. He signed, scored a lot of goals, and that was it. And they won 5 European Cups.
That's basically it in a nutshell.
But, I mean, we could probably do a whole episode on how he signed for Real Madrid. I mean, we could easily do a whole episode on
it. Oh, easily.
Yeah.
Without doubt, and it would be very complex, and there's a lot of detail. And I think what we're going to have to try to do is simplify the signing, because the signing is very complex. At the risk, of course, of maybe not treating it with the nuance that perhaps it needs. But I think it does need to be simplified, because otherwise we could be here literally all day.
What chapter is it in your book?
I don't know, 6 maybe?
Go read 7. Chapter 6. It is a great one. So you're in for a treat. But yeah, if we don't do it full justice here, go and read Sid's book.
I mean, look, this is probably, arguably the biggest kind of sliding doors moment in football history.
Yeah,
without doubt.
Everything could have been very, very different if this transfer had turned out.
Absolutely. I do write this in the book, but that it was something that really, really struck me. I interviewed Juan Santisteban, who played with Alfredo Di Stefano, was very young. Played with Alfredo Di Stefano, and we've been talking for, I don't know, an hour and a half, nearly 2 hours at the Bernabeu, and at the end of it we were sort of getting up ready to go, and I turned the tape off, and he said to me in a kind of conspiratorial tone, he said, "Whatever anyone has ever told you about Alfredo Di Stefano, forget it." And I thought, I don't believe it. He's, you know, having just told me how wonderful he is, he's about to say, fundamentally, you know, he wasn't that good, or he's massively overrated, or something like that. And I was like, hey? He said, whatever they say, they can't do justice how good he was. There is nothing and no one who ever did what Alfredo Di Stefano did, who ever played like Alfredo Di Stefano played. Now, of course, this is one of his teammates, but I was really struck by this kind of, you know, come closer, son, I'm going to tell you something. And I thought he was going to blow the myth of Di Stefano out the water, and instead he kind of did the complete opposite. And as Al says, the sliding door moment, I mean, it's difficult to properly do justice to just how much difference he made.
He was going to sign for Barcelona.
Yes, and this is the thing. So he was going to sign for Barcelona, and we'll come on to that in a minute. And instead he signs for Real Madrid. The truth is that when he signs for Real Madrid in 1953, Real Madrid are not that good,
mm-hmm.
right? We're talking about a team that since the end of the Spanish Civil War, Real Madrid have won the league. Not once.
Okay, that's 1939.
It was 1939, yeah, sorry. Atletico Madrid have won the league 4 times. Barcelona have won the league 5 times, including the last 2. So we're talking about the dominant team in Spain who have Kubala playing up front, probably the best player in the world at the moment, at the time, even though obviously I think a lot of people with hindsight have no longer heard of him. I mean, people of our generation largely haven't heard of him. We're talking about a period in which Atletico have won the league, Valencia have won the league, Sevilla have won the league, Real Madrid haven't. Of 14 post-war domestic titles in Spain, Real Madrid have only won 2, which are 2 cups, 2 Copa del Generalísimo. Barcelona have won 9. So this is the best team in the world about to sign the best player in the world, and Real Madrid get him instead, and everything changes.
Hmm. How did that happen then?
Well, I say everything changes, by the way. It's worth pointing this out. They've 2 league titles in their entire history pre-Di Stefano. They've got a total of 32 now, Real Madrid, or is it 31 leagues they've won in their history?
31.
31. They win 8 of 11 league titles with Di Stefano. And, of course, above all else, they win 5 European Cups in a row. The first 5 European Cups in which he scores in all of the finals.
Scores in every single final.
I mean, we're talking about someone who's quite good at football, right? I mean, genuinely, I think if it wasn't for the fact that he didn't have an impact at the World Cup, I think he is in the conversation with Pelé and Maradona. I don't think there's any doubt about that. And in Spain, I think for most people, he still is in that conversation. But outside of Spain, of course, because he didn't have that international projection, despite the European Cup, because of the lack of World Cup, it just, you know.
Real Madrid have won it 33 times. Of course they have.
You took
always
2 league titles.
Always talking down, aren't you, Kito?
You took 2 league titles off Real Madrid. So there you go. So 33 titles. In other words, they've scored 2 in the pre-Di Stefano era. Scored 1. And 31 in the post-Di Stefano era. Mm. Right, so what happens with his transfer? And I'm going to try and simplify. Alfredo Di Stefano belongs to River Plate in Argentina.
Mm-hmm.
He's playing for Millonarios in Colombia. Now, the Colombian league is considered a pirate league by FIFA. It's a breakaway league that breaks from FIFA's control. There is they're trying to find a solution to this, and there's a thing called the Pact of Lima, obviously a pact signed in Lima, in which all players in the Colombian league are allowed to stay for the time being, but in October 1954, automatically revert to their original clubs.
Right.
And those Colombian clubs accept this, and they can't do anything about it. So he's a River Plate player at Millonarios. To cut a very long story short, which we'll then expand upon, Real Madrid, Barcelona do a deal with River Plate. Right. Real Madrid later, and this is a key question, do a deal with Millonarios, the club where he is on loan.
Okay.
The Spanish state becomes involved. There is a letter, as I found in a government file, which had never been seen before. I mean, the day I found that file, I was literally sitting there looking at it going, don't fucking believe it. I've got not quite the smoking gun, but very nearly. I've got this piece of evidence, and there's 2 or 3 really interesting documents in there. One of them is the original letter between the head of the Spanish Football Federation and the head of what's essentially the sports ministry, the DND, the Delegación Nacional de Deportes at the time, in which he says, well, Real Madrid has signed this deal, but this deal is papel mojado. In other words, it's not worth the paper it's written on. Literally, wet paper. It's not worth the paper it's written on. It means nothing, Real Madrid's deal. The state recognised it meant nothing. It becomes entrenched, though, because they're in a situation where Millonarios won't let him go. He's already said to Millonarios, by the way, I'm just going to retire. I've had enough. I can't be bothered with this. Barcelona do the deal with River Plate.
Wait, I'm going to retire?
Yes.
From football?
Yes, he was going to retire. He'd had enough. He was going to just ditch it all.
Oh, wow.
We're talking about a different era, of course, when playing football doesn't necessarily make you the same kind of money. So you have a situation where he arrives in Barcelona in the summer of 53, and he arrives in Barcelona to sign for Barcelona, but Barcelona talked to him, and he always refers to it in his book, I quite like this, as the third man. So they say, we've got you, and we've got River Plate who own you, but we need to strike a deal with Millonarios to get you from there now. Obviously, we could just wait until October 54 when you revert to being a River Plate player anyway and just take you then. But that's still 16 months away. So they try and do a deal with Millonarios. Now, of course, part of the problem is that they know that at the most from Millonarios, they're buying 16 months' worth of player. So they're refusing to pay the kind of money that Millonarios are asking for. They've paid over 4 million pesetas to Millonarios. To River Plate. Millonarios want 1.5 million, what's essentially 16 months' worth of player. Mm. And they're saying, no, Real Madrid, go to River Plate, and then this creates a stalemate.
Hmm.
again, to cut quite a long story short, a stalemate which is incredibly embarrassing for a lot of people, in particular for the state. A stalemate in which basically one of the things the state does is say, well, you know what, tell you what, we pass a law. No foreign players. Tough shit, neither of you can have him. When that doesn't work, and here's one of the curious things about it, that doesn't work. The two clubs together,
yeah,
together accept mediation from Armando Calero, who's a FIFA, a Spaniard at FIFA. They accept mediation from him, and they write a letter requesting that this ban be lifted. So the two clubs in this are in it together, because they think that there will be a solution found.
Hmm.
When that solution is presented to them, that solution is, tell you what, Madrid for a year, Barcelona for a year, Madrid for a year, Barcelona for a year, across a four-year period, and then we'll deal with it at the end of that four-year period.
That was the solution?
Which is
that
a massive was, cop-out.
That was Di Stefano's response. Di Stefano's response was, these people know nothing about football. How can I go to one, score for one week, and score for the other another week? So you get this situation which both clubs think, well, this is ridiculous. So Barcelona try and get out of it completely.
Mm.
And they try and get out of it completely by going to River Plate and saying, can we have our money back?
Mm.
River Plate say no. They then try and sell their share to Juventus. Juventus are not that interested because, of course, they know they're going to have the fight over the other part of it. And so you get this scenario in which the solution is no solution, and Barcelona eventually sign away their rights and they say to Madrid, you can buy our bit. The question mark is why?
Mm.
And that's where you get all the suggestions of pressures being placed upon the Barcelona president, who then resigns and, in a very enigmatic resignation letter, does suggest, hint very, very heavily that, yes, indeed, there was significant pressure brought to bear on him. And I think without the involvement of the Spanish state, there's a very strong probability that he would have signed for Barcelona. That said, it's slightly different from the usual version of this story, which suggests that the state systematically tried to make this happen.
Mm.
I think a more realistic interpretation is to suggest that the state tried to resolve a very, very messy situation.
Hmm. Obviously, as we said, I mean, there is a wealth of stories within this story and within just him before he even became a Real Madrid player. Obviously, the signing, as you've gone into some detail here, but there's a lot more that you could talk about.
Yes, there is loads more, yeah.
Which we're not going to, but like we said, check out Chapter 6 if you want to. I mean, the programme is, well, the show that we're doing here is more about the impact of the,
yes,
of the signing, right? Yeah. But this is such an interesting signing, the story of that we had to talk about it. The impact that he had, it's really hard to sort of overstate how important he is to, yeah, Real Madrid, to their history, to their identity, how closely linked he is. I mean, Al and I, obviously, we moved here in 2012 and subsequently we've been working with Real Madrid TV. I don't know about you, I wasn't aware of Alfredo Di Stéfano. I mean, I'd heard of the name, but I wasn't aware of the sort of aura and everything that went around him and how important he was to Real Madrid.
No, and I think maybe I became aware of that, actually, when he died.
Yeah.
Because when he died, we did a special programme on Real Madrid TV about him and his impact, and that was when I sort of started to get more of a sense of it. But also, I think we can take it a bit further, because we talk about his importance, his impact for Real Madrid.
Mm.
You can also say that because Real Madrid at that time, in his time, was so important for the European Cup and its development.
Yes.
That also comes from, indirectly, from him.
Yes. I think there is an argument that says that in terms of the impact a player has had on, if you like, modern football, Alfredo Di Stéfano is the greatest player of all time in terms of the impact, in terms of how much things change, in terms of how much of what happens now is explained by a player. I think Cruyff, if you add Cruyff the manager to Cruyff the player, maybe Cruyff is higher.
Mm.
But I think Di Stéfano, in terms of purely what he did as a player, because there's so many elements to this.
And, well, obviously, his success in the European Cup and what he did with
the European Cup. As well as making Real Madrid,
and it makes Real Madrid.
And it makes Real Madrid. So you're talking about, without Di Stéfano, there isn't Real Madrid the biggest club of all time. There isn't the European Cup. Or maybe there is. We don't know how it would develop. But there isn't the European Cup as being what it is. There isn't that sense of identity for Real Madrid. And I think one of the other things about Di Stéfano, it's not just how good he was, it's that he was different to other players. And actually, when you listen to him talk about it, as I've done, obviously, he talks about his role, and there's an element of Messi about it.
Mm.
He just talks about himself as a withdrawn striker, and a guy that would come and get the ball and play and make everyone else play and would run the game, but I think much more aggressive than Messi. And that's one of the other elements of him, is his personality. And I think one of the things, you talk to people at Real Madrid, this idea that he represents the values and the symbolism of Real Madrid, which actually at times, let's say, aggressive, could occasionally be nasty, grumpy, direct, but incredibly competitive. And there's three or four very famous stories about him, like the one where he's got a player following him around and he says, it's a young player, and he says, are you going to just follow me everywhere, son? And the player, I think it's Osasuna, but I must confess, I can't remember who it was. He says, well, yeah, my manager's told me to. He said, all right, you can follow me around if you like. You might even learn something. And so Di Stefano just kind of wanders around the pitch. There's another one, a European Cup game, when he's man-marked but by two players. And he literally takes himself out of the game, goes and stands on the wing and says, just stand here then. And just, I mean, obviously, it's been exaggerated with time, a bit like the kind of the angler's fish story that gets bigger and bigger with every retelling of the story. But the story is told almost if he stands on the touchline and doesn't move and says, these two can stay with me.
Obviously, you interviewed him, didn't you?
I think I might be the last person to ever interview him. Yeah, because he was 87 when I interviewed him, or, yeah, 87, I think. He was very good company in a kind of gloriously kind of grumpy sort of way, but really, yeah, very cantankerous, really, really interesting. He talked a lot about the pressure, and it's very clear listening to him talk, how much of it he didn't enjoy, how much of it he felt under pressure, how much of it he felt an obligation to perform, how much he was aware of players perhaps not being given the money that they were generating for other people. He talks about flights, and then it becomes clear there's a moment in the conversation where I think, the reason why he keeps going back to this is because he was terrified of flying. And I actually asked him, so you were frightened? He goes, oh God, yeah, I absolutely hated it. I hated seeing those mountains just by you and that sort of stuff. And there was a real kind of a human element to it that I thought was very interesting. And, you know, as I say, that edge with him, and genuinely teammates of his would say, you know, at times he could be a total bastard, he could be horrible, he could call you every name under the sun, he could confront you all the time. There's a very famous story of Amancio in a pre-season game, I think in Africa, but I'm not completely sure. Amancio is this big summer signing from Deportivo La Coruña, I think in 61, maybe 62, comes to Real Madrid, most expensive player they've ever signed, very good player, by the way, an absolutely brilliant player, and Amancio is in going to pre-season, he sees his shirt hung up, and he picks up his shirt and he says, there's no badge on this shirt. And Di Stefano famously says, you've got to sweat it. You know, in other words, you've got to sweat the shirt to earn the badge. And that phrase, in a way, we're talking about the values and the idea of an identity for Real Madrid, that phrase, in a way, I think is probably the most famous phrase in Real Madrid's history in terms of encapsulating that. And it's curious that Real Madrid have created a mythology or an identity through sacrifice and effort, when they're the richest club in the world, and in a sense they're the opposite of that. But Di Stefano was the embodiment, if you like, of being the most talented, being the most expensive, being the player that you bought, and you could accuse him of buying success, and yet at the same time out on the pitch, aggressive, go for it, you know, just the, as I say, that sense of this is what our values are,
and the idea that the one thing you can't get away with is not trying.
It's not trying. Yes, you can get away with some other things, but you can't get away with not trying. And one of the other things Juan Santisteban said to me, he says, you know, Di Stefano, he could be shouting at you all game, run, stop, run, go there, go right, go left. And he said there was one game where he turned around and he said, Alfredo, if only I could run like you. I'm trying. I am trying.
Okay. Well, let's move on, because we do have quite a bit still to talk about. And go to 1973, the summer of, where Ajax sold Johan Cruyff to Barcelona for a then world record fee.
Yes. 6 million guilders.
6 million guilders. Sounds like a lot.
Free for him, free for Ajax.
Yeah.
I must admit, I'm not sure what 6 million guilders is in pounds.
At the time, it was almost £1 million.
Yes.
At the time.
Yeah, it was just because, of course, the first £1 million player was Trevor Francis, which is actually, what, 3 years later, maybe four, I'm not entirely sure.
And as we said, the rest is history with Johan Cruyff, but not just with him. It was not just what he did on the pitch, but what he subsequently did.
It's the ideology.
Well,
I mean, with Cruyff, it's the ideology, isn't it? And we're talking about the values of Di Stefano, but if anyone embodies the values of Barcelona, it's Cruyff, someone who seemed to understand the Catalan question. But more than that, it was about the idea of, you know, we play, and we have a very clear... So with Barcelona, there is obviously a narrative made about their social and political ideals, if you like. But actually what Cruyff did was give them a footballing narrative to go with it, both as a player, where, you know, teammates talk about him revolutionising the game's teammates. I mean, I remember Reshak saying, you know, it used to be run, jump, fight. With Cruyff, it was play.
Yeah.
And it was so that the whole ideology was different. And obviously this is an Ajax philosophy. And a lot of what we'd say about Barcelona, a lot of what we believe to be Barcelona's philosophy, is actually an Ajax philosophy. And it's not purely about Cruyff, but a big part of it is about Cruyff.
Well, and you hinted at this earlier, Sid, when comparing him to Di Stefano. You know, without Cruyff the player going to Barcelona, you don't have Cruyff the coach going to Barcelona.
And you don't have Barcelona's
first European Cup. Hmm. You don't have the focus on La Masia, the philosophy. You don't have Xavi and Iniesta.
Guardiola.
I mean, take it all the way up to Spain winning the World Cup in 2010. Yes. You know, that's sort of the logical conclusion a process that starts with Cruyff going to Barcelona.
To the extent that Vicente del Bosque will admit that. I mean, a lot of Madrid fans don't like the fact that Vicente del Bosque would admit that, but he will admit that there is a line of continuity from Cruyff through to the Dream Team, and actually an element of continuity, Cruyff through to the Quinta de la Buitre, the Real Madrid team, through to the Dream Team, through to kind of, if you like, the modern obsession with technique and touch and position, above all, positional play. And Cruyff, in that sense, is absolutely massive.
How important was his embracing of the Catalan idea?
Well, I think it was important in terms of making him a legend for Barcelona fans. I think it's... I mean, he understood it, but I think he understood it in very broad brushstrokes. You know, just this idea of we fight against injustices. His words, not mine, by the way. Mm-hmm. I'm not necessarily taking this on at face value. That we represent something social. That we represent something that goes beyond purely sport. Whether that's right or wrong is obviously another question. Certainly in a modern day incarnation of it. Obviously at the time with a dictatorship, perhaps it's different. Obviously this is famously embodied in when he played in the 5-0 against Real Madrid in February 74, and they destroy Real Madrid, and there was a sense that this is a game of huge political significance. And in particular, he plays because the birth of his first son, Jordi Cruyff, of course, went to play for Barcelona, Manchester United. Mm. He's been sporting director and manager at Tel Aviv. And
manager of AEK Larnaca.
Well, there you go, exactly. The high point of his entire life, I'm sure. And, you know, the birth of Jordi was brought forward so that he could play in that game. So there's already that sense that, wow, he did something amazing, and then he played, and then he did this hugely symbolic thing.
And
then he called his son Jordi, and he wasn't allowed to, because Jordi was a Catalan name, and names had to be Castilianised. He went to the civil registry, and he told me this story.
Because this is still the final year of the dictatorship.
Yes.
And actually, those final death throes of the dictatorship were pretty...
It was almost worse than the previous 5 or 6 years. And so he goes to the civil registry, and he tries to register his son's name as Jordi, which obviously in Spanish would be Jorge, in English would be George. Mm. Patron saint of Catalonia, obviously patron saint of England as well, and of Georgia. And so he goes... I don't suppose that was the reason, though. He goes to the civil registry, and he told me this story, and I love the way he tells it as well. And he says, so Jordi says, you can't be called Jordi. He said, what do you mean you can't be called Jordi? It's not allowed. What's not allowed? Well, you can't be called Jordi. No, but what do you mean? What's not allowed? Well, his name has to be Castilian. He says, I'm Johan. He's Jordi. And basically, the guy says, I can't write it down for you. And so Johan, the way he tells the story, he says, all right, don't write it down then. I'll take him out. I won't register him. Don't write him down. Don't write him down. And in the end, basically, you could see that Cruyff was prepared to just say, bah, sod it, I'm going. See you later, no worries. I'll sign him up somewhere else. Mm. And in the end, it gets written down. And at that stage, genuinely, there were virtually no one in Catalonia under a certain age called Jordi. Now it feels like everyone in Catalonia is called Jordi.
I'd say sort of 60 to 70% it's called Jordi.
And this was really symbolic. And yet again, this brings us back to that idea of how much did he embrace the Catalan ideal.
Yeah.
He says, I quite like the name, and it was good, and I wanted to do it, and it was my son, and I wanted to call my son what I wanted to call my son. He's not there saying, I wanted to make a bold statement. I wanted to ingratiate myself with Catalonia, or even I wanted to embrace the Catalan cause. You asked Jordi, and I spoke to Jordi about this, and Jordi's, well, I think he just liked the name. He's never really talked about it that much to me. It was just kind of a thing. But, of course, for everybody else, it was the thing. Mm. It was just massive. And this, again, is similar in his transfer. Real Madrid made a bid for him, and Santiago Bernabeu tried to sign him, although he later claimed, I didn't like him because of his jeta, his cheek, you know, his arrogance. Mm. That's not true.
Didn't want him anyway.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, that's exactly the point. I asked Cruyff, why did you sign for Barcelona, not Real Madrid? And he said, because Ajax sold me to Real Madrid. And I said, no, I decide. So if you're selling me to Real Madrid, I'm going to Barcelona. Don't tell me what to do.
And was that quite indicative of
that, exactly, him as a person? Exactly, that is kind of Cruyff. And there's this lovely line where he says, like, people always said I was difficult. I wasn't difficult. I was just fighting for what I thought was right. Mm. And he talks about himself as being part of the Beatles generation, that idea of challenging authority, that idea of social change, and that idea that you know, and Johan Cruyff, obviously, with the long hair, he was kind of bohemian.
He
was bohemian, and, the smoker, you know, almost hippified a little bit. And Joan Laporta, you know, always tells us, the former Barcelona president, always tells about, you know, when he was a kid growing up, he wanted to be Cruyff. And, you know, he would do his hair like Cruyff. And he just changed the way that people looked at everything, really.
Hmm.
And in particular, of course, football.
Hmm. Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, as we said, two of the most iconic players from the past in Di Stefano and
also one other very brief thing, livestock.
Yeah, pigs.
Yeah, yeah, good footballer, not such a good businessman.
Yeah, so
made some poor investments. Yeah,
but, and also that the livestock thing was curious because he was signed and there was some problems with signing him. And so in terms of the, I think it was in terms of the customs declaration, he was declared in customs as bien somminovente livestock. So I asked Cruyff, do you know what you were written down as? He said, yeah, I think I remember I was officially 15 tractors or something. Nearly, it was livestock. Cruyff was officially registered as an importer of livestock.
What?
Yes, exactly.
Why?
Because there was some sort of paperwork, customs-related issue.
I thought you were going to talk about him and
his
That's another element.
His ill-fated pig farming.
Another element of things that... Yeah.
But there we go.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Etsy. Looking to instantly upgrade your Mother's Day gift from typical to meaningful? Shop Etsy. Now until May 12th, get up to 30% off personalized jewelry, style, decor, and so many other items mom will love. And if you want her to know you put a ton of thought into her present, use Gift Mode. Gift Mode on Etsy takes the stress out of gifting so you can easily find well-crafted, original, and affordable pieces from small shops. Just tap or click Gift Mode on your Etsy app or Etsy.com. Then answer a few short questions about mom, and Gift Mode instantly gives you curated ideas based on hundreds of personas. Need something original and affordable for Mother's Day? Etsy has it. Shop until May 12th for up to 30% off gifts for mom. Terms apply.
Why is it that with sparkling water, I'm always playing guessing games with what flavor I'm drinking? Is it citrus? Is it aluminum can flavored? Not sure. Sparkling ice, though, they really mean flavor. Like in-your-face flavor. Orange mango, black raspberry. Don't even get me started on the strawberry lemonade. Kiwi strawberry slid right into my taste buds' DMs last night and let them know who's boss. No subtleties there, and no sugar either. But it does have vitamins and antioxidants. Find sparkling ice at a major grocery store or club retailer near you. Sparkling ice. Anything but subtle.
All right, let's move on and talk about Leo Messi, who, as we've said many times, is quite good at football. But he was.
We're going to talk about someone else who's also quite good at football before anyone gets angry with us.
Yes, we don't have to do that much anymore, though.
No, but every now and again, it still raises its slightly ugly head, doesn't it?
Yes. All right, we're going to talk about Ronaldo in just a moment, but obviously Messi signed for Barcelona. When was he technically signed? Is it February 2001 or is it December 2000?
He went on trial with Barcelona in 2000. Yeah. I think the contract, the famous contract on the paper napkin.
Yes.
Maybe that's going into. I think he moved to Barcelona in February 2001.
Yeah. Yes. And then
but then he couldn't actually play. Well, this is properly, this officially.
Is thing. Yeah. And there was this contract written on a napkin. This is written at Pompeii Tennis Club and. Charlie Reshack is there, and Charlie Reshack is there with Orazio Gaggioli, who's his agent. And basically, they're waiting for this to be done, and Barcelona aren't financing it. And Reshack, and I think this is really interesting, Reshack writes, I, Charlie Reshack, in my capacity as technical secretary for FC Barcelona, and this is the key line, I think, and despite the existence of some opinions against it, commit to signing Lionel Messi as long as the conditions agreed are met. And the contract was signed then, and then the proper contract, this was
it in... It doesn't sound legally binding to me, I would say.
This is exactly... But then the proper contract is signed later on. But that napkin still exists. I think Gaggioli has got it.
Wow.
Every now and again you see... There are photos of it, actually, if you look it up online.
I mean, that's got to go in a museum.
It's got to, hasn't surely. It?
Yeah. Absolutely.
This is definitely our youngest transfer, by the way, of all the ones that we've covered so far. We haven't had any actual child transfers, have
I
we?
Mean, that's true. I was...
I mean, there should be a FIFA ban for this, shouldn't there?
Yeah.
For all this child transfer. I mean, he was obviously, as a lot of our listeners will know, but Barcelona found a payment for his father, were trying to look for a job for his father, and of course they took on the most key element to this was they took on the payment of the hormone treatment that he needed because of his stunted growth. It cost him nearly $1,000 a month. And that was one of the reasons, of course, why Newell's old boys weren't prepared to keep doing this.
Yes, absolutely. And that's why, well, he came to Barcelona, and as we say, the rest is history. But
he copied me, though. He came to Barcelona. When he was in Barcelona, he stayed in the Hotel Raleigh, which I sometimes stay in. So obviously he was copying me.
He copied you?
Well, actually, he probably got to Barcelona before me. When did he arrive? Yeah, he got to Barcelona before
me. You might have been there around the same time and just
not
known it. You know
what? We could have been in the two rooms next door to each other. Yeah. He was probably in the room next to me.
Yes.
I taught him everything he knows, you know.
Well, he's taught us some things as well.
Yep.
What has he taught us? Five things.
Five things?
What have we learned from Leo Messi?
I suppose he's taught us that that you can have a bit of everything. You can have vision, you can have dribbling, you can have finishing, you can be a player who plays all over the pitch. It brings us back a little bit to
Di Stefano.
That you can be arguably, you know, the best or one of the best four or five footballers in history without necessarily being physically brilliant. Because actually physically he's not that brilliant. I mean, I'm not saying he's not an athlete, because of course he is. I don't know, what else has he taught us?
I'm not sure. But has this signing perhaps...
Does it really count as a signing? I mean, as you say, it was a kid's signing. Yeah.
It's a kid's signing. Did that, the fact that Messi was signed so young, did that maybe accelerate other child signings?
Possibly.
And the fact that he was found and think, oh my God, we get the new Messi?
Well, I mean, joking aside, I'm not... Would the way that he was signed now, would that be against FIFA?
Probably,
rules? Because this is why we've seen Atleti and Real Madrid, Chelsea recently punished... For these kinds of transfers, bringing in very young players from overseas.
In theory, the player has to be in the city or in the catchment area, which obviously depending on the different countries and depending on how close the cities are to each other, that catchment area is a different, that radius is a different size.
Rosario is definitely not close enough to Barcelona.
For reasons not to do with that child's footballing development. Now, obviously, there have been ways around this, or at least clubs thought there were ways around this, and now they're being caught out for it. And obviously, he then goes into a youth team as a 13-year-old with a certain Francesc Fabregas and Gerard Piqué, and Marc Valiente, and one or two others as well.
I mean, what is there left for us to say about Messi? Obviously, the impact of his signing is fairly evident. It's, I guess, continuing the legacy that was started by Cruyff, as you mentioned. Yeah. Obviously, that legacy from Cruyff has been far and wide-reaching. But, what else can we say about him and this signing?
I think...
I mean, it's genuinely difficult. I mean, I don't know. I suppose we have to include him.
I suppose you can say that there's an importance in identification as well, that, all right, he's not a Catalan. All right, he's not a kid who grew up supporting Barcelona, but he joins Barcelona at 13, and he is going to see out his entire career now. Admittedly, if Barcelona weren't a great club, he wouldn't be seeing out his entire career there. But I think perhaps had he gone to Barcelona as a 22, 23-year-old and been this good, I think the chances of having seen him then take a subsequent move, say to Man City, or for argument's sake to Juventus or to wherever, probably would have been higher. I think there is a value, even though he was an imported player, albeit at 13, I think there is a value in the loyalty and in the fact that, I don't know about you, I'm quite pleased with the suggestion that the best player, potentially the best player of all time, if and when he finishes career, might well have played his entire career at one club.
Well, there's also the question of...
I quite like that.
You say that if he'd have joined at 22, but there's the question of would he have been this good if he had joined Barca at 22 and not as a kid? Because, you know, the suspicion is that part of what makes him so unique is innate talent, but also the fact that he's been in the Barcelona system
Well, Reshac says this.
And surrounded by the players that we've mentioned.
Yeah. Reshac says this, that the game he went to see Messi play in, which was a specially organised friendly because Reshac had just come back from the Sydney Olympics, and he turned up late. For what it's worth, Reshac turns up late to everything. Reshac's been watching him for 2 or 3 minutes, says, sign him. He's absolutely unbelievable. And he is kind of credited as being the man who discovered Messi. But he always says, well, any old idiot could have discovered Messi. He said, that said, he went into the perfect ecosystem. He went into the kind of club that played the kind of football that enhanced his qualities, that rather than try to make him, to go back to that question of physicality, bigger and stronger. I mean, obviously, they were trying to make him bigger because he had growth problems. But, you know, try and make him an athlete. But no, we embrace what he does and we fit that into a model that has worked for him. I suppose you could argue that there have been times in this Barcelona period when that model hasn't entirely worked for him, and that maybe he's been almost too good even for Barcelona. But yeah, I mean, as you say, had he been a 13-year-old at, say, let's say he turns up at Liverpool or he turns up at Bayern Munich or something like that, Would he have been the same at 22? I guess the answer is probably not.
No, I mean...
So maybe he's a product of Cruyff as well?
Yeah, potentially. I heard Fernando Redondo speaking about him the other day. Did you hear him speaking
on the radio,
about Messi? And he was asked, you know, would he have been the same player if he turned up at Barcelona, maybe at 18 or 19, even still young? But he was like, I don't think so. I think he would have been more... And the word he used was silvestre, which wild.
Yeah, that's a great way of looking at it. He would not have been so refined.
Yeah.
And I suppose there is that question mark of to what extent is he a product of the professionalisation of the structure, and to what extent is it a product of just pure talent? And obviously there's an element of both. Also, I suppose there's another question that's linked to this, which is, would Argentinian national team fans have embraced him more had he not come to Spain at 13?
Yes, definitely,
absolutely. Yeah. And yet he has still got a very strong Argentine accent.
Yes, he has.
A complete Argentine accent.
Yes, he has.
It's not in any way Spanish. And moving here as a young child, it's incredible how he still maintained that. But I think it's important for him to maintain it.
Yes, I think that's probably true. But you're right. I mean, you meet kids who are abroad for a couple of years and they pick up the accent. I mean, my brother's kids, for example, lived in the US for a bit, and they're not Americans, but there was touches of American accent in the way they spoke. Yeah.
People ask my mum why she's still got a Greek accent after all these years in England. She says, because I want to.
Good answer.
Yeah, which I think might have a touch with Messi as well. Maybe he wants to. He still needs to maintain this connection.
Exactly, hold on.
I mean, he went back
to
Rosario to get married. That's a big thing. That's a huge thing. You know? So maybe the important or the interesting thing about Messi's signing was when it happened, and that conditioned the rest of his story. Cristiano Ronaldo's signing happened later in his career. He was very much a formed player. That's completely Spanish.
Yeah. Well, you know, he was a Ballon
fully
d'Or
developed.
Winner.
Fully
you know,
developed.
He was, just won the Champions League with Manchester United. He was recognised as he'd won the prize for being the best player in the world that previous year.
Yes, absolutely. He was at the very top of his game.
And he went a year later as well. Because the deal was essentially not... The deal wasn't actually done a year earlier, but he went a year later because essentially Manchester United were in a position where they could see where this was going. And Ferguson said, look, given the way that Real Madrid had behaved... Because remember Ferguson coming out, talking about Franco's club, talking about I wouldn't sell them a virus, talking about there's no way this kid he's going to go. And essentially the deal in the end, because there'd been an agreement which put a private and never publicly recognised buyout clause into his contract at Manchester United. Ferguson was basically, look, I will let you go next year, but given everything that's happened this year, I can't let you go now. Stay, have one more brilliant year, and he did, and he was absolutely fantastic. And in that sense, I think his attitudes are absolutely irreproachable, and you can go. And what happened then, of course, was that Cristiano Ronaldo phoned up Ramon Calderon, who was the Real Madrid president, who'd set this all up, and basically said, look, I'm really sorry. I owe everything to them. I owe everything to Ferguson, who's like a father figure to me. I have to stay for a year, but I will come next year. And then, of course, they put everything in place.
I wanted to put Ronaldo in the programme that we're going to do about bargains, but he probably fit
because
better
at 90,
here.
At 90...
94 million euros.
Are we calling it 94 or 96? Depends on the exchange rate, doesn't it? But yes, it was £80 million.
£80 million. Absolute bargain.
As it turns out, it probably was, wasn't it? It's quite amazing because, you know, bear in mind that when Florentino Perez took over as president, he effectively inherited the deal with Ronaldo, but it took 10 days before it was pushed through.
Yes.
Because he was trying to get a bit of a discount on it. He was trying to suggest that, well, maybe this is a bit too much and so on. And I think, in a way, I don't think that was necessarily because he thought it was too much, but I think it was probably a way of trying to own the deal, trying to make it about him. Because one of the things that annoys Florentino Perez more than anything else is to be reminded that the best player he's ever had was not signed by him, but was signed by the previous president, a president who he absolutely hates. And so I think maybe there was an element of trying to own the deal a little bit through those kind of last-minute negotiations. I don't genuinely think there was ever a chance the deal didn't happen. But it has been suggested that there was a chance that it didn't happen. I don't think that's the case.
Obviously, Alfredo Di Stefano, absolutely fundamental and crucial to Real Madrid's five European Cups in the 50s. Ronaldo, right at the heart of Real Madrid's four in the last 5 years.
Yes, absolutely. Of course he is. Absolutely is. I mean, I know there's a... And I sort of want to... I sort of almost feel like lashing out at this point. There's a kind of a sneeringness about people who don't support Ronaldo and talking about how just scoring tap-ins and penalties and all that. I mean, seriously, piss off. I mean,
the idea that Ronaldo only scored tap-ins.
And by the way, even if he did,
he scored 500 of them.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And so, you know, and it is true actually that in terms of the league, his league record in Spain is relatively poor.
Well, it's 2 in 9 years. Know, and certainly when you make the comparison with Di Stefano,
winning the league, yeah,
because we say that Di Stefano,
not his goal scoring.
You know, we say Di Stefano came and won 8 leagues out of 11 with Madrid. Mm. Ronaldo came and won 2 out of 9. Mm. So when you make that comparison, he comes off poorly.
Yeah, and you know, and also I mean Ronaldo. You once said, if everyone was at my level, maybe things would be better. And I think it was when they were going through one of their periodic crises. And everybody laughed at that and said, isn't he arrogant? And it is funny. And yet at the same time, actually, it's basically true, isn't it?
Well, yes. But, you know, he did have to
mind
say
you,
it.
You mind you, you can't have 11 players at that level. Where are you going to get 11 players from at that level? Yeah,
it's not rocket science, is it?
Yeah, exactly.
Yes. But yes, obviously he's proved a hugely significant signing for Real Madrid. It still feels a bit weird he's not here, I have to
say. It does a bit. And here's the question. I mean, given that, you know, we're recording this podcast at the moment in which we're recording it, at a time when Real Madrid have been knocked out of the Copa del Rey, we're basically out of the league title, and you know, we're only just into March. And is there an argument that says that we're starting to find out how important he was, and that maybe this year we're seeing even more important than he already was? Except, of course, as we've just said, this was happening with him.
Mm.
And we don't know, you know, how this all ends. You know, last year they finished 17 points behind Barcelona with Ronaldo in the team.
There was a graphic in AS that I think we tweeted the other day from the podcast to Twitter account about the amount of goals that Madrid have scored at this stage of the season.
26 over the last 12 behind,
years.
I think.
And basically, they had a nice little graph, and you saw the Ronaldo years, in which every single year they'd scored 100-plus goals at this stage of the season. And you saw before Ronaldo and after Ronaldo, when they were nowhere near. They were on like 80 something.
In a word to define Ronaldo, I've always thought this, relentless.
Relentless, yes.
Above all else, relentless. And actually, if you go back and you read stuff, biographical stuff about him as a kid, walking around the streets with weights on his ankles, the way that he trained. I mean, it's almost uncomfortable to hear kind of the level of obsession, but it's clear there was something there. I know this is quite a big leap from Ronaldo, but I was in Malaga recently speaking to Jack Harper, who of course is a Scottish player who was a youth teamer at Real Madrid at the time when Ronaldo was here. And he said, oh, I met him a couple of times. He's not going to claim to have seen him train, but he said, genuinely, I don't think I ever saw his car not there in the car park. Mm. So, you know, I'd turn up at training, he was already there. I'd leave, he's still there. He was always the first in, always the last out. And and Jack describes it as an obsession. He says, I think there's something deeply obsessive about him. Because in a way, if the secret to Ronaldo's success is just the hard work, well, everyone can do that.
Yes.
But it's the talent plus the hard work. And actually, maybe the hard work is of a level that's so extreme, so absurd, that even the most dedicated players in the world don't match it somehow.
So perhaps the signing obviously worked on a number of levels, and one of those levels might have been bringing that obsessive, relentless desire to win to a club like Real Madrid and trying to sort of inculcate it to everyone.
And to come back to that question of values, to fit with that idea that what we do is the product of hard work. Even in this case, even in Di Stefano case, when it's also the product of buying the best player around.
Yeah.
But that best player then embodies that for you.
It's interesting, though, that in the league, at least, that relentlessness didn't translate into
which it should do, because
the
in theory, the league is about regularity and relentlessness.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes.
It should have done, but it didn't.
But they're also up against, you know, one of the best club teams ever for quite an extended period.
All right, listen, we're going to leave it there. Thank you for joining us at this look back on the 4 biggest impact signings in the history of La Liga, certainly in the history of Real Madrid and Barcelona. We'll have another episode coming out in a couple of weeks where I think we're going to talk about the biggest bargains.
We've got bargains to look forward to. Yeah. Later on, we've got flops to look forward to as well.
Flops is going to be the most fun, I think, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. But yeah, thanks for listening, and we'll be back soon. See ya.
Cheerio.
Bye.